So while this is loading, thank you for being here this morning. My talk, as advertised, is focused on private providers, and I think it's actually a nice complement to what we just heard from Christine. She's talking about health plan level, and she showed that little schematic. You know, there was the, on the left side, the little provider box feeding up into MIC or whatever. Well, this is going to maybe put a little bit of a magnifying glass on that. But one thing is a little bit different. You'll hear this is focused on reminder and recall. All the providers in Michigan, as Christine pointed out, are required to report. So there's different nuances of how do you use a registry. Everyone in Michigan by law reports. What I'm talking about is using its functionality in a different way. So that's what we're going to focus on. And so just to kind of set the stage and make sure everybody's on the same page. I'm talking about reminder and recall, and I guess, I don't know, too often we use that as if it's like one word, reminder, recall, but I'm sorry about that. But just let's get the definitions out so we all know what we're talking about here. When I talk about reminders, I'm talking about a proactive or preemptive, if you will, notification of a dose that's coming due, kind of a heads up. Whereas recall is typically reserved for, this is a notification that you or your child is overdue, past due. So that's the nuance there. So that notification, as you're probably well aware, can be accomplished through many mechanisms. Most typically, we're dealing with mailed notification for larger scale reminders and recall. It certainly can be done by telephone, auto dialer, and the like. And then certainly in this day and age, we have the option of other modalities, including email, text messaging, and perhaps other modalities. But this roots back to the evidence that we have at this point suggests that reminder and recall in different settings, different situations, there's kind of a whole bunch of studies out there that have been cobbled together. But basically, at this point in time, the best available evidence does confirm that that is an effective means of bringing up childhood immunization rates. So it's a good tool, and that's why we want to use it. So, as we just heard from Christine, the health departments certainly, health plans certainly use reminder and recall, but health departments are very active, and certainly in Michigan, using reminder and recall notifications. In addition, so those are kind of like population-based methods. In addition, primary care providers, which would be more like to their panel of patients, certainly can and do to some degree use reminder and recall, but really that last bullet is it's kind of where things are kind of on a limited basis, if you will. Very few providers, private providers, at least at this point, tend to use reminder and recall notification, at least through the immunization registries. And that really leads us to kind of I guess pondering the a question or a hypothesis, which is, is it the costs of reminder and recall in that private provider setting that might be perceived as a barrier to those practices? Is that what's going on? Is that perhaps seen as a barrier for expansion? So that leads us to the objective of our study here today, which is really we want to look at the cost of immunization recall by private providers, and the emphasis here was on recall, although some of our providers actually opted to do reminders as well. So we're going to look at the costs of that exercise by private providers. Our study design was certainly only possible due to a really quite excellent collaboration between the immunization folks in the Michigan Department of Community Health, the Michigan Care Improvement Registry team, which really was key to the study, and then the Alliance for Immunization in Michigan Coalition, which, if you don't know, is a large coalition throughout the state of Michigan, mostly in the southern tier of the state. So you might know them from the AIM Toolkit, which you'll probably see here at the vendor tables or whatever. That's the same group we work with. Okay, so our study design focused on private practices in the greater metropolitan Detroit area, right? So those practices were invited to participate in an intervention. That intervention was aimed at increasing the use of immunization recall, specifically using the MICR. So this whole exercise is aimed at using the Michigan Care Improvement Registry for recall as opposed to some other mechanism. Our participants were specifically asked to conduct these immunization recalls aimed at 19 to 35 month old children. So I have to say that that was the emphasis here. Now they were free to recall or address other groups if they wanted to, but we were focused specifically, we asked them to at least include 19 to 35 month old children in their efforts. So. In order to accomplish this, the study participants were provided with hands-on MICR training and ongoing technical support, and you'll see a lot about that in just a moment, but that was a big part of this, which is to get those practices ramped up and ready to actually use the MICR tool to conduct recall as opposed to just reporting the data into MICR. The objective of ours, the goal we were asking the participating providers to reach was to conduct 4 recalls over a 1-year period, so just kind of notionally a quarterly recall cycle, although they weren't locked into specifically doing it on a quarterly basis. We wanted them to achieve 4 recalls as our measure of, quote, sustained use of reminder and recall. So we also provided practices with really the material supplies to do these reminder or recall mailings. In other words, we gave them postage and paper envelopes, all that, so they didn't bear any of that cost. That was provided by the project. Another aspect of special interest was as they conducted these recalls, there was a great deal of post-recall follow-up. In other words, recall was completed and there'd be many questions or technical issues or why did this happen or whatever. Any of those kinds of dialogues were immediately addressed by the MICR technical team. So there was a lot of that hands-on and person-to-person follow-up with each of the sites if they encountered any problems or how to make it smoother next time, all that sort of thing. So in order to do the cost part of this, practices recorded labor hours associated with each step of the recall process. And I'm going to walk you through quite a bit of that in just a minute. But basically what we're doing is saying, okay, for different tasks associated with running reminder and recall with a registry, we wanted them to keep track of their time. So we actually developed this little timesheet for practices to sketch out kind of on a grid fashion, basically, who, meaning was it a medical assistant or a nurse or whomever at the practice, and how much time did they spend doing this activity, running the recall, sorting through addresses or whatever. So that was kind of the timesheet aspect of it. And then to actually convert that into costs, we used U.S. Bureau of Labor job classification averages to take those time counts, the hours, if you will, and apply average rates to get our total costs for this study. So in addition, I should point out that at each of these sites, our participating sites, we had quite a bit of face-to-face contact with especially the practice managers, prior to the intervention, during the middle, at the midpoint of the intervention, and then at the conclusion of the intervention, just to get a lot of the narrative to go with, just how's it going, what are the issues, what are the aspects that the numbers aren't necessarily going to show, but the narrative would. So we have a great deal of that information as well. So let me just say a little bit about site recruitment, because that's actually kind of a story in its own right. And if you were here at the conference last year, I focused a presentation on issues related to site recruitment, but I'll give you the Cliff's Notes version. Basically, as I mentioned, this is in the greater Detroit, Michigan area. We were it was necessary for us to actually address 2 different areas. Kind of the design was prescribed in a sense that we needed to look at 2 communities in this area. One was going to be our intervention community, and one was going to be our controller or comparison community. And we had to select these areas which were demographically similar in all aspects. And when I say demographically similar, I'm talking about looking at zip code and census level data with respect to the underlying population of children, as well as the provider population. And so we were aiming at including as diverse of a population as possible. And it was almost one of these puzzles trying to, well, we want to have urban, but we also want to have rural, and we want to have ethnic diversity, and we want to have small practices and large practices. It was really quite a challenge to come up with a design. But we did, and I'll show you how we went about that on the next slide. But this whole thing kicked off in February of 2007, where we sent out invitation letters to all the providers in our targeted areas, and then we started making phone calls with the recruitment process, trying to get these practices to participate. So I hope you guys can see that in the back, but obviously the state of Michigan, I was going to say, Christine had the Michigan GIS thing going there for a minute, but kind of stepped it up here, put it on the screen, but you get the idea, Detroit. So this is actually the Tri-County area, Oakland, Wayne, and Macomb County surrounding Detroit. I hope you can see that shading. Well, let's see if I can use my little pointer here. But basically, we have two regions here. They radiate from basically the inner city of Detroit on out. So that's our kind of gradient from inner city Detroit on out to, actually, this is quite rural out there. And likewise, we have another set of zip codes and census tracts radiating out kind of on a diagonal. That's our study area, again, defined by census tract and zip code. We selected, as if you heard last year, we had over 100 practices in these areas identified, and when it was all said and done, 21 actually agreed to participate. So I won't digress on that, but that's actually an amazingly low participation rate in my book. So we had our project, as I said, recruitment started in February. The intervention part actually kicked off in March of the following month. So March 2007 through May of 2008 is our study time period. As I said, 21 sites agreed to participate, but 21 agreed to participate, but I want to distinguish that from the ones who really did participate, which is not the same thing. So 21 said yes, 17 actually went so far as to get trained, so that's important. If they were to participate, they have to get the training, because that's actually the part of the intervention. But actually, of the 17 sites that were trained, only 16 sites, or most, but one did not participate, actually, even though they were trained. So 16 sites actually conducted a total of 56 recalls over that period of time from March 07 through May of 2008. Just to give you a quick overview of just like how that went. So 94% of our trained sites actually did at least one recall. 82% did two. Just about two-thirds completed three recalls, and then finally, just over half hit the mark that we were hoping for, which is four or more recalls. So that's kind of the beginnings of the story here, where as we continue through the results here, you're going to see we have these practices, 16 of them running recalls. They're very, very different in a lot of ways, including the number of recalls that they ran. So just kind of keep that in mind, and I'll come back to that as we show you some results. And I did point out that one site did not conduct any recalls. So as we go through the next few sets of slides are going to focus on cost. I'm going to first walk you through cost by activity. Then we're going to look at cost by labor category, who's doing those activities, and then finally I'll walk you through some I think really interesting variations on at each of the sites. How did that play itself out, because these sites are all different and there's a kind of a different story at each one of them. So just to begin, as I mentioned, 56 recalls were conducted. Those 56 recalls entailed 909 labor hours. Now, I should point out that those 909 labor hours were conducted during the business day, so this is not a weekends and evenings kind of a deal. This is just during the typical workday is when those recalls and recall-related efforts were conducted. When we apply those averages that I mentioned, the Bureau of Labor averages, we come up with just over $26,000 in labor cost. Materials were not terribly expensive, but it adds on just over $860 worth of, you know, stamps and that sort of thing. And what I will be walking you through over the next few slides then are these wide variations that I'm alluding to, both in terms of how they spent their time in terms of the different recall tasks, how the labor mix was different, and that those differences kind of working together were quite variable at the different sites, at our participating sites. And that's where we're going to be heading with our results here. So for, just to start off with then, orient you to this slide. This is the 909 hours of labor that I spoke of just a minute ago. But the first display, if hopefully that pointer is showing up there, is going to be organized by the activity, which is across the x-axis here on the bottom. As you can see, starting at the left, roster gathering, that is pulling together the lists of patients at your individual site to be eligible for recall at your site using MICR. That was the most time-consuming effort of the entire exercise, taking up just about half of the time. So of the 909 hours, half of it was spent on roster building. The next most most common task, or most time-consuming task, I should say, was MICR training, which was just over a third of the time. And I think what's striking then is, so that's these two bars, roster gathering and training, that's 80% of the time, which is to say, actually doing the recall, running it, mailing it, dealing with the undeliverables, that's less than 20% of the time, which I thought was actually really interesting. So this is the same information, same x-axis, except now we've converted that to cost. And the only reason I show that is that it's basically the same pattern. The cost follows that same pattern, largely attributed to roster gathering, which is almost half of the cost. Okay? So let's just talk about that first bar for a little bit more. I want to put a magnifying glass on roster gathering since so much time was spent there. Let's just dig into that a little bit more. So again, just to get the definitions out of the way. When I talk about rosters, at least in the context of MICR, and quite frankly, I don't know how other registries necessarily refer to this this concept, but what we're talking about is a practice-specific list of active patients. So in other words, they're not associated with your practice by some default association, like having their last dose there. This is a group of patients which we could start from scratch, a blank slate, and start building it, saying these are the kids that I see on a routine basis, these are the ones that I would like to follow, this is my panel of patients, whatever terminology you'd like to use, but that is the concept of a roster. And as you can appreciate, if I start with a blank slate and say, okay, I've got all these kids in my practice, I want to start building that, that could be a really time-consuming process. It's done through either billing records, medical record pulls, chart pulls, you name it, but there's a real time-consuming process involved with getting those rosters built. And once you build it, it's not done. As a matter of fact, it's never done. It's an ongoing work from month to month. We get new patients coming in. You have former patients that you wish to remove. That is a big deal, and it's a really time-consuming deal. So let's take a look. One view I want to share with you is, since so much time was spent on roster building, I want to show you a little bit of, like, well, what is the bang for the buck here in terms of how much work was done with respect to those rosters with in comparison, rather, to the control site. So this first line you see, which is basically the roster counts, this is not for our intervention sites, but this is for our comparison sites, the control group sites. Starting in March 2007, here on the far left side, those sites, without any training or intervention or whatever, in sum, had about 500 kids in various rosters, okay? And what I want to show you is over the course of our intervention period through May, those control sites increased the kids in a roster modestly, I would say. It basically goes up to just over, I think it's over 1,200 kids in the rosters. So from about 500 to about 1,200 at the control sites. The news here, though, is if you look at the intervention sites, they start out at a little higher level, about 1,000, a little over 1,000, but over the same time period, they're building these rosters to just over 3,700 kids, new kids added, and I should say, and it doesn't say on the slide, these are the 19 to 35-month-old kids, because some of them were building rosters for different age groups, so this is just the 19 to 35-month-old kids. So this is that, basically that's the fruit of that labor I was showing you. Those are the hours that are being, those hours that were being expended are being expended to achieve this gain. Okay, so I mentioned we're going to talk about labor category. Basically, I've showed you the tasks that are being done. Who's doing those tasks? So just to orient you to this slide, again, back to our 909 hours recall or labor devoted to the recall process. Now along the x-axis we have seven different categories of labor categories, that is, ranging from office managers, nursing staff, and medical assistants, which you can see here. Those three groups actually are over half of the time devoted to this recall process, most of it by office managers, just about exactly a quarter. But if you combine them, you get about half the time right there. Interestingly, 12% of the time was recorded by physicians. And then lastly, you'll see just little bits and pieces of time devoted to the recall by nurse practitioners and then other office staff. But this last column is an interesting story. So as I mentioned, this is a time-consuming process for building those rosters and for training. And there is the time right there that takes to train those sites. 30% of the time, the total time devoted to this recall process was by the MICR technical staff. So these hours here on the left-hand side are the hours at the practice sites. This last bar, and I set it off on its own to distinguish, those are MICR technical staff who come in and train and assist the sites. So the news here, this is the same display of labor categories across the x-axis, but now we've converted it to dollars, and you can see that it is a different pattern. Most evident here is this physician time. If you recall the previous slide, it was 12% of the hours. Well, it's almost 30% of the total cost. So obviously there's a differential in labor rate there. So that's the news there. So obviously physician time is expensive. I think that's probably worth noting as we go through here, because you'll see some interesting differences as a result of that. So one last thing about the MICR technical staff. So I noted that there's 30% of the time and just about 30% of the cost attributable to MICR technical staff. What were they doing? I went back to one of our the display that showed the distribution by task, and I've just highlighted the hours of the MICR technical staff in each of those bars. And you'll see that most of their time was devoted to MICR training, which makes total sense. And about 5% of their time was actually with assisting kind of in a roll-up-the-sleeves fashion with some sites that had some difficulty with roster gathering and building those rosters. So most of our time is spent on training. So let's look at the cost variation by site, because I think this is where it gets really interesting. I'll walk you through really four different views of how we can look at cost. There's really a lot of ways that we can look at this, and we continue to look at it, but for the purposes of today's 20-minute talk, I've just kind of picked out a few kind of key tidbits to give you a flavor of what's going on here. So to orient you to this slide, if we take that total cost, the $26,000 of cost I mentioned, and now we organize it by sites, and I've got my sites here, which you may not be able to read that, but it's basically the letters of the alphabet, you can clearly see that this is sorted by descending total cost. Obviously the most expensive or most costly sites, I should say, are here on the left-hand side, descending order, ranging from $8,000 for the most costly on down to just a few hundred dollars for the least. So that's probably the first take-home message then with respect to sites. They are very, very different with respect to the amount of labor and obviously the cost affiliated with each of these sites. That will play itself through in the ensuing slides, as you'll see. So I should point out that site Q here, you saw the labor hours for the physician and that the differential in labor cost for physicians. Well, actually, this is the only site that reported physician hours. As a matter of fact, most of this bar, if I showed it to you by labor category, most of that bar would in fact be physician time. So that's kind of an interesting story in its own right, but we had kind of a physician champion who really wanted to do this, do it well, do it right, and she basically did it herself. And so that's what you got right there, $8,000 for the recalls. So we can talk more about that as we go on, but that's clearly a difference from many of the other sites. So when we look at then costs, those total costs, now divided by the number of recalls, and I think I may have skipped a slide. Okay. So now let's take those total costs that I just showed you and take each of those sites' respective number of recalls that they ran and do the math and basically say, okay, let's look at the cost per recall. These bars, even though, again, you may not be able to see the letters, they're sorted in the exact same order on all these slides. It's the most costly practices on the left side. And so a couple things to notice is now when we look at cost per recall by site, when you have costly sites but run a lot of recalls, you know, do the math, well, cost per recall, that's going to go down because you're doing lots of recalls. So you'll see that some of these sites, even the site that used physician time, actually the cost per recall is relatively modest. I expect that you could say it kind of levels it out a little bit because they actually ran 4 recalls, and that brings it down a little bit more to earth. But other sites ran 5 or even more recalls. So that cost per recall is a little bit more level, but the notable difference here is this one site, Site K. It's an important site to point out because that gives you a real bird's eye view of what one recall looks like. This is actually a fairly large practice, and they were really intent on participating. They got their training, they got themselves geared up, they got the staff all ready to go, and they rolled up their sleeves and they built the rosters, and the roster was, you know, modestly large. It was not a tiny site by any stretch of the imagination. They ran the recall, and then the site was basically bought by another practice, and that was the end of their participation in their study. So I do want to point that out because there's a lot of ramp-up costs, and well, there's the cost per recall for a site that does one recall. So just kind of keep that in mind as we go on. So another dimension that you could say makes a difference here, and that I argue that distinguishes these sites, are they're not all the same, as I mentioned, and one dimension that distinguishes them would be their patient panel. Well, I did mention that they spent all this time building these rosters. Let's take a look at how big those rosters are, and that's what this chart shows us. Again, these bars are counts of children that were added to the rosters by site. They're in the same sort order, so our most costly sites are still on the left here. A couple things to point out. Well, so amongst the most costly sites, you might say, well, if they're really costly, it might be because they've got lots of kids, right? You got to do a lot of work to get all those kids in a roster. So, okay, so there's a couple really big sites, actually the largest sites up there with the costly sites. So that makes total sense. But just, you know, before you get too excited about that association, you know, you look at site P, that is not a large site. It was actually one of the most costly sites. They're very costly with respect to the number of kids in their rosters, okay? So another view here then, we look at cost per child in the roster. Again, Site Q is the site that had all that physician time, so they actually look expensive when we look at this in terms of cost per child that was added to the roster. This is the largest roster site, so they were very costly in a sense, but they had a ton of kids. They had a really, really large roster, so the cost per roster or child in the roster is driven down. This site, PE, I include just to point out the fact that they had difficulty. The roster was not particularly large, but they had a lot of time spent on roster building. This is one of those nuances of the site. They just had issues, I guess is the way to say it. They had a lot of difficulty getting those rosters built and cleaned and maintained. They spent a ton of time on it. Okay, so I guess we're just about out of time. And so I'm going to zoom through this this summary with just kind of putting this in the equation form very quickly. I've shown you all how we've computed the cost. It's basically simple math in a sense. It's the time spent times the labor rate. That labor rate can be differential in terms of the type of labor. And the things I want you to walk away with today are staff turnover is a big issue. These are kind of those background issues that I was speaking of. The number of recalls obviously affects the total cost. But one thing I refer to is site business practices. Those are basically the level of organization. How good of a job do they do in terms of just kind of organizing themselves to do their daily work? And that has a big factor. And then lastly, the reliance on technical support has a big issue here. I'll conclude by just saying costs for immunization recall in the private setting are definitely affected by a variety of practice and staff characteristics. I've shown you that the higher cost of those initial recall cycles reflect the time and effort to get ramped up and implement those new systems. Conducting recalls during the regular work hours, that has some implications that need to be explored in terms of opportunity costs. In other words, if you're doing recalls, are you not doing something else? and we can talk about that more during the questions if you'd like. And then lastly, the need for outside technical support is considerable at many sites, especially just for that ramp up to get that initial recall off the ground, but then as sites experience turnover due to staff leaving or maternity leave or whatever. So just lastly, keep in mind there's economic feasibility of practice-based recall does in fact depend on site business practices and their capacity to do these tasks during the regular business hours. And to tie into what Christine was talking about, those cost savings doing recall may not be due to sites trying to achieve cost savings. There may be market factors such as health plans offering incentives that may encourage private practices to get involved. So that's something to keep in mind as we go through our questions. I'll conclude by acknowledging my team back at the University of Michigan, Michigan Department of Community Health, Michigan Care Improvement Registry, and the AIM Coalition folks, and certainly the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So my little commercial for tomorrow, if you want to hear more, session J4, a couple more presentations, you can hear more about our work, and I'll conclude there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And we got about 7 minutes for a couple of questions.
Hi, Diana Bartlett from CDC. I just had one question from the last speaker. Did you provide any guidance for the definition of active patient to develop the rosters? It seems like that was, if there was a standard, I was wondering if there was a standard definition that you had all the groups use, or if the providers were asked to make that choice themselves. I know because the registry can produce or give them a sense of who an active patient may be, but unless it marries well or complements well with what's in their chart, it may take additional time to clean the roster if there's a difference between what the registry may think is active versus what the provider thinks is ultimately active based on chart records.
Yeah, so we did not prescribe a definition, I guess, if that was the first part of your question, but we let the sites kind of figure that on their own. But a lot of them had strong feelings about that, which is to say, they would say things like, okay, we're willing to do this, but I don't want to be sending recalls and paying for this to recall somebody else's patients, right? I mean, you know, so not, this is not like a public health department. This is you doing it for your practice. So they were really keen on, let's weed out the ones that aren't our patients. How they did that, a lot of that, and that's where the time-consuming part came in. They might review lists of the kind of default MICR association, say, you know, that kid we haven't seen in ages, that kid we haven't seen in forever. A lot of these practices were small enough that they could actually kind of go at the kid level and kind of sift through it. So I don't know if that really answers your question, but it was not prescribed, but it was more of a site-by-site kind of roll-up-your-sleeves kind of effort.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
To what extent are you telling us that these practices don't have an active list of patients? I mean, that seems to be the read between the lines here. And it seems like that such a list or such a roster seems like a useful thing for extremely wide range of practices. And it seems unfair to attribute the cost of developing such a list to immunization-related activities.
Right, it's a good point. But many practices seemed to be able to produce such, I guess we'll call it a list, without much difficulty. And I guess maybe that's the next steps of where our analysis goes, which is, you know, what makes the most sense to really attribute as a cost. But very definitely, some sites, this is not an issue. In others, it's a very real issue. Many of them, I think I mentioned, would use their billing systems as a quick jump start to that. And that's actually, I think, some practices might have been a little bit more savvy on how to do that more readily, whereas others weren't. So I think it's a good point. It's a good point.
Did you do any comparison on the cost effectiveness of your study group as compared to a control group who didn't make all these efforts to actually get patients back in for vaccinations?
We haven't done that yet, but we're going to. That's a part of the study, but the data I showed you today was about as far as I could get with respect to the control group versus the intervention group, but that is a part of the plan. Okay. Thank you.
Hi, Mary Beth Carrillo from Oregon. I'm just wondering if, as you have these practices go through and set their rosters, did they also then give Nicker information on what kids were bogeyed or inactive in their practice?
So did the practices, I'm sorry, I missed the last part of that. Did the practices provide information on which kids were bogeyed?
Yeah, feed that back into the registry.
Yeah, that was a part of it. So that, you know, when they were trained, that was definitely, you know, let's connect the dots here. If we can't find this kid, or if they've, you know, the kids moved to Indiana, you know, or something, they're known to be getting healthcare, you know, elsewhere. Yes, that they were trained to do that. How well they followed up on that is kind of another story for another forthcoming paper. But
hello, Anna Dragsek. I missed the first part of the talk, so I apologize if you already addressed this. Did you do a pre and post COCASA to measure the rise in immunization rates at the clinic level to determine the success of your project?
We have those data. They were just actually completed like about a week ago, so we don't have for the talk. But yes, we definitely have that, and that is a part of it, to look at those rates just prior to the intervention, through the intervention, and following it. But so yes, stay tuned.
Any more questions? Well, we are right at the time, so I'd like to thank again our presenters for their presentation and